Hello, and welcome to the Strand Group podcast. I'm your host, Martin Stolliday. A few weeks ago, Sir Tony Blair came to speak to our students who take the Strand Group modules, The Blair Years, The History of the Prime Minister in partnership with Number 10 Downing Street, and our undergraduate module, Prime Ministers and Leadership Since Thatcher. On today's episode, we can share some of Blair's answers with you alongside expert commentary from my two guests. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Michelle Clement, who runs our Blair Years module. Her PhD was on the art of delivery, Sir Michael Barber and the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit, 2001 to 2005. She's also the researcher in residence at Number 10 Downing Street. Our other guest is Michelle's co-teacher on the Blair Years, Blair biographer, The Independent's chief political commentator, and visiting professor, John Rentoul. Welcome both. Michelle, before we hear from Blair, what can a student who takes the Blair Years module expect?
Thank you, Mark, and grateful to be on the Strand Group podcast. So the Blair Years postgraduate class was founded 15 years ago or so by John Rentoul and Professor John Davis. And I, you know, came along in the recent years and then started leading it a few years ago. But really, there's nothing else like it in the country. John and JR designed it to be a module that basically uses the most up-to-date diaries that have been released and memoirs, but also bringing the practitioners into the classroom. And in terms of our approach, we're looking at the policies that were pursued, we're looking at the processes, so the machinery of government, which can seem boring, but often isn't when you get into it, but also the personalities. And that's where, you know, because of the diaries that have been released, because of John and JR's book, Heroes or Villains, and also because of the practitioners, we actually get a real sense of what it was like at the time. So, I mean, we cover the whole period, you know, we look at Blair the man, we look at Gordon Brown's relationship with the Treasury, we look at the foreign policy, the domestic policy, and we get a whole array of people who worked in that government, from the advisors to the civil servants to the secretaries of state and even Tony Blair himself. So it's, you know, it's a fantastic module to teach, and our students have enjoyed it for a good 15 years now, so, and keep coming back.
Thank you, Michelle. John, hearing from these practitioners, that's what it's really all about, isn't it? And that's what the answers we're going to hear on the podcast today are about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we started this course in 2008, it was only months after Tony Blair had stood down as Prime Minister. And there were some people who raised their eyebrows at the idea of doing a government which had only just ended as history. Especially as Gordon Brown was still in Downing Street, and therefore people might feel a bit constrained in speaking out. But as Professor Hennessy, Professor Peter Hennessy, Professor Peter Hennessy, who is our sort of guiding star, as he said, you know, imagine if at the end of the Attlee government in 1951, we'd been able to do what we did in these courses and get the members of the cabinet, the top civil servants, and the political advisors of that government to come and speak in classes about what the government had just been doing. It is, we hope, a sort of priceless insight into how government works. I mean, obviously, over time, it has become much more like conventional history. I mean, there were things, you know, when the course started that we weren't familiar with. I mean, we didn't even know about the financial crash at that stage, which, you know, colours some of the judgments looking back. But we've now got to the stage where, you know, the BBC is making documentaries about that period, and Professor John Davis and I were consultants to that documentary, and it's now filling out the history of that period. But it's still valuable, I think, to hear from the participants in it, and particularly from Tony Blair himself.
Absolutely. I think without more further ado then, and thank you for explaining the module, but why don't we hear from Sir Tony Blair himself? Michelle, you asked Sir Tony about the formidable women at the centre of his operation. Let's hear what he said.
It's a good question, actually. And first of all, it's very nice of you to invite me along, and it's a very weird thing to be studied. Which my 21-year-old son actually finds particularly weird, because he's having to study me too. So, well, the women were really important. I mean, you had Sally and Angie here. Well, that would have been entertaining as well as important. Yeah, I don't know. I think we made a lot of change. You know, there were a vastly increased cohort of women MPs when we won in 1997, more women in cabinet. Actually, the first women to be chief whip. They were more polite, but actually more ruthless than the male chief whips. And I think, was Margaret Becker the first woman foreign secretary? Yeah. So, why haven't they? It's a good question. I don't really know. But for us, you know, for those of us who were there, they were incredibly important. And really, I mean, particularly Sally and Angie on the political side. Yeah.
Thank you, Martin. Yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity to be able to ask Tony Blair about these women. I mean, firstly, the reason I asked it in the first place is what we understand about the Blair government is that really the people, you know, the secretaries of state were absolutely important, so, and the cabinet were, and the civil servants were, but really the special advisors around Blair were of a different quality. And they really played a key role in shaping the government from as I mentioned earlier, policy and process perspective. And we know some of these stories because many of these people have written books. Jonathan Power's written a brilliant book, The New Machiavelli, Andrew Adonis, Sir Michael Barber, on which my PhD is based, and others. But what we haven't seen is these powerful behind the scenes women writing books. We haven't seen, you know, very influential women, and their role was different, but actually, you know, as someone like Angie in the first term, Angie Hunter, she was as important as Jonathan Powell and Alistair Campbell. She hasn't written a book, and you know, for various reasons, her story and the impact she had has only been partially captured. And so, you know, I think this, we've got a missing dimension in terms of in our understanding of how the Blair government sort of worked in practice. And so the second term, Sally Morgan was, played a similarly important role as Angie Hunter, you know, and Sally and Angie have contributed to our modules across the years. But again, capturing the full story of what their role entailed, how they got to where they were, you know, the pivotal roles they played in different crises, and the thing that, you know, we never know as outsiders, or typically we don't know as outsiders, the things they managed, the crises they managed to stop happening. You know, so much work often goes on in government in this, you know, this big debate or this big policy that is going, you know, downhill. How do we save it? And from the outside, we don't know about all of the work that goes on that side. So I think, you know, it's a missing dimension. We haven't got the stories that are captured in books, really. You know, they do feature to an extent. But I think, you know, another women like Sue Nye, who was key to Gordon Brown's operation throughout, Liz Lloyd, who was Deputy Chief of Staff by the end of Blair's premiership, they played key roles. And so I just think trying to understand how they worked and their role is really pivotal. And actually, I was looking in Jonathan Powell's book, The New Machiavelli, and he was saying that his bit on this was Angie Hunter and Sally Morgan, two strong women, provided Tony with a reassuring antidote to Alistair's and my own abrasiveness. And they took on much of the burden of sitting in the den, listening to him complain and building him up. They knew his wishes and could convey them confidentially to ministers and others. And that's rung true with, you know, we've had other individuals speak to us from all sorts of policy areas, from defence and from education. And if they needed to know Blair's mind, you know, they'd be contacting Angie and Sally as much as they'd be contacting Alistair and Jonathan Powell. So their role was critical, and so I just wanted to understand Blair's perspective on that. And I think his answer was good, and there was a final question as well that a student posed about the role of Sue Nye and Sally Morgan, and Sue Nye and Angie Hunter, because they played this role which was kind of little known. You know, we understand that the Blair-Brown dynamic in government, that rivalry, meant that there needed to be brokering done, and that was often done by Jeremy Hayward and Ed Balls. But there was also this other sort of forum between Angie Hunter and Sue Nye, and they helped to resolve differences too. So, you know, understanding that is important too, and Blair touched on that in the final question as well. So yeah, that's my two pence.
That's great. Thank you, Michelle. Obviously the students have different questions and they're interested in what's going on in the moment. And Blair was asked about how his doctrine or the doctrine on liberal intervention applies with the current crisis in Ukraine. Let's hear what he said about that.
I think it's important to state what we mean by liberal interventionism and what we don't, because liberal interventionism as a term, I mean, and I'm partly responsible for this, has come to mean, as it were, something that is purely based on idealism or based on globalism, which today seems to be an insult. And really, if you make it into something much simpler, that the argument behind it is this, that in an interdependent world, it actually matters what happens elsewhere. And if you get chronic instability in one part of the world, then it's going to affect your own country and your own interests ultimately. And today, you know, there's no point in getting away from it. The two different competing value systems. I mean, first of all, the world has changed dramatically in this sense, that the West is no longer the center of the world, right? There are other poles of power in the East. And the geopolitics of the 21st century will be dominated by the rise of China. You'll have India, which in time, if it kind of sorts itself out, will become the third big giant in the world. And, you know, all around the world, you're getting regional groupings like ASEAN, for example, in Southeast Asia, which will be building influence and heft. Now, some of these countries are aligned with our value system, but some of them plainly aren't. And therefore, what is important is if we're going to defend our values and our interests, you've got to be prepared to be out there in the world. And, you know, obviously what for a lot of people gave liberal intervention a bad name was what we did post 9/11 in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. But, you know, if you take, for example, what you wouldn't call liberal interventionism, you might call illiberal interventionism that Russia has been engaged in over really quite a long period of time. I mean, roughly the last 15 years or so. Then if you take Africa, my institute will publish a paper on this in the next few days. They have moved in a big way, right? They are now very influential in several of the African countries. Obviously, they're very influential in the Middle East. In Syria, by contrast with Iraq and Afghanistan, they held through 11 years of intervention, despite the fact that the person they were propping up was killing their own citizens, using chemical weapons against their own citizens. And so when people debate liberal interventionism, I will say to them, it's not as if we're not intervening anywhere, someone else is not doing something, right? Mm-hmm. Other people are intervening. China does it much more through soft power, is true. Although, again, as the paper we published yesterday shows, you know, they've increased military spending dramatically, but One Belt, One Road, which you may have or may not have heard of, which is their play really across a whole swathe of Asia, you know, is a massive soft power engagement. I think in the next few years, it will become apparent that in certain areas of technology, China will be superior to America, and it is a different value system. And I quite like our value system. So it's important, I think we realize in this that if we're not doing things in the world, it's not as if no one else is, because they are. And in the end, if you want to defend your values and your interests, you've got to be prepared to stand up for yourselves. And I think, you know, Ukraine has kind of brought that home to people. I mean, I have a project in Ukraine with the Institute. I've been there every year since leaving office, apart from one of the COVID years. And, you know, you've got a whole cadre of young people there who are Europe-oriented, really smart, really clever, want to get connected to the world, and they're presently being crushed. Now, if we kind of let that happen, okay, but, you know, you're giving a message to the people who are opposed to our value system that we're really not prepared to defend it. So anyway, it's a long answer, my apologies. But I think it is a really important thing for us to consider what it is we mean by it and how we engage with the world.
John, that's a very interesting answer from Tony Blair there, sort of classic Blair, if you like. I think it's clear that a lot of his work now takes on this global perspective. What do you make of that answer?
Well, it was a very interesting and full answer and a defence of liberal interventionism. And as he said, events since his time in power have proved that the alternative to liberal interventionism isn't just the world carrying on in a sort of neutral gear. It's illiberal interventionism, and it's allowing those countries that do want to use their intervention force abroad to set the agenda. And I think that's a simple thing he was trying to say, as well as also defending, I think, the idealism behind those interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, more particularly, and before that, Kosovo and Sierra Leone, where Tony Blair's government was much more successful, and accepting the need to rely ultimately on military force if you are to defend the values that we hold dear.
Blair was then questioned on some of the differences on the domestic sphere and what he learnt in his first term compared with his second term.
It's an interesting point. So the thing about, I think that's really weird about politics, is in no other walk of life would you take someone I had no experience of government, right? The first and only job I ever had was prime minister, which is, if you're going to do it, I suppose it's quite a good place to start. But the point is, in no other walk of life would you do that. You wouldn't, if you were owning Manchester United, you wouldn't say, right, we're not going to have an established manager. Just which fan cares most? Yes, you're going to manage the team. You'd say, well, that's insane. Okay, but this is how, so the thing is that when you come in, you don't have that experience. And I certainly, my first term, I thought if we just beat the system harder, it will work more effectively. And truthfully, it did work more effectively when you beat it harder to an extent. But if you stop beating it, it stopped working harder. Right. So in the second term, we really changed the way that government worked. And a lot of what my institute does now around the world is focused on this question of how you structure a government, really reference to what we did in government, which is in that second term, we created what was called a delivery unit that's now replicated in many parts of the world. We basically have a strategy unit, a delivery unit, a policy unit, communications. So we tended to focus on core things that we believed absolutely had to get done and how we got a different, a different culture into the public service of implementation and delivery. That change in the second term was extremely important. It allowed us to make more radical reform in things like health and education, criminal justice, and other areas. At the same time as post 9/11, my second term very quickly became dominated by foreign policy, or dominated by it, but it was a whole dimension that was immensely important. So I think it's... changing that structure of government was really, really important. And I think, it's a... Because we do this in different countries around the world today, I think there is a science of governing. There are rules to governing. And just like there are rules to leadership. And I think it's really important that people who are in positions of government study them, because I can tell you the hardest thing about government is getting anything done. I think I may have said this last time I was with you people, when we had I had the top civil servants in to lunch in Downing Street after I'd been about 18 months into the job, and I explained to them my vision, and one of them said to me after about 45 minutes, said, yeah, I think I get what you're saying, you actually want us to do something. And I said, yeah. I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, no, you've got to understand the system is geared around policy advice, not implementation. But you're now telling us to shift to implementation. So I wasn't at that stage able to do it in the same way, but over time we were able to do it. And by the way, the great irony of government is just by the time you got the hang of it, they throw you out. So.
Fantastic answer there. Michelle, you've written the PhD on this. What are your thoughts?
Thanks, Mark. I could do whole podcast series on this. It absolutely fascinates me because this is, you know, what it is to be Prime Minister. I mean, I think firstly, the first term was really shaped by how New Labour got into government, how they won the 97 election. You know, they agreed to stick to Conservative spending plans for the first 2 years. They had relatively modest, domestic priorities. And they didn't necessarily know they were going to win the majority that they did win, you know, and so it took time for Blair to learn on the job. And the first term is really the story of Blair learning to be Prime Minister. But he learned pretty quickly. You know, there were big achievements, you know, the Northern Ireland peace process, the constitutional reforms, the things that Gordon Brown was doing in the Treasury around welfare reform, operational independence of the Bank of England. But in terms of the, you know, domestic reforms, really, this was Blair in the first term. He was really learning what he wanted to do. You know, he had Frank Dobson as health secretary to begin with, but towards the end of the first term, it got Alan Milburn in there. And I think, you know, he realised within about a year that the scale of the victory meant that the expectations of the public were bigger. And he had people like Peter Hyman in Number 10 looking at this and trying to understand delivery. But really, you know, they were trying to understand what they wanted to do. And Blair talks in his biography about looking back after a year or so and sort of laughing at the modesty of the initial priorities. And, you know, it's not to say they weren't important. They absolutely were. But he realised that he wanted to do more structural reforms. And so the story really is how Blair learned, you know, how the public services were working during that first term, and partly how he learned was through some of the crises. So the fuel crisis and the foot and mouth crisis, the NHS flu crisis, you know, he learned how the system could work and how it couldn't. And also by 1998, you had the big spending review, which gave 3-year settlements to departments. And this, you know, really allowed for forward planning and gave a big boost of investment into the public services. And then they created these public service agreements, which were a whole raft of sort of targets to link to the money that was being invested. And really, then you get to the end of the first term and they, you know, they think it's possible that they're going to win second term. And what they want to do is have a big quantum leap. And not only in terms of policy, but also the structures to support the policies, because by that point, as Blair said, he'd realised the limitations as well as the advantages of the civil service, that, you know, excellent policy advice, but delivery had not been an explicit part of their role. And so the creation of, the strategy unit, the delivery unit and other units was pivotal. And they got that underway as soon as they'd won the 2001 election. And so Sir Michael Barber ran the delivery unit, and Blair, you know, to his absolute credit, kept plugged into that throughout all of the foreign policy crises of the second term. And, you know, Michael Barber did a sort of masterful job in terms of, bringing in the Prime Minister where he needed him to be brought in, but not bringing him in unnecessarily. And then also building excellent relations with the Treasury under Gordon Brown and Ed Balls and Nick McPherson, who was one of the key civil servants there. So I think, you know, the first term is really about learning how to govern. And actually there's advantages to the relative naivety. I remember asking Blair about that when we launched Michael Barber's new book, Accomplishment, last year. If he'd done things differently, if he'd already had, you know, if he'd already been a cabinet minister before then, he may well not have been as bold and as radical at changing how the system worked. And so there was, you know, there's value to not knowing how the system works. And we saw that with Northern Ireland peace process and other areas. But really, by the second term, it was deeply important that the Prime Minister could get into the detail of how public services worked and how he could change that and improve outcomes. And that is what he did. So I think, you know, he gave a great answer. I can expand on that because I've written a PhD on it. But, there's so much to learn for governments going forward from that. And it's, you know, there is that dichotomy between, you know, naive thinking, oh, well, if I'd known more, maybe I would have done more in the first term. But if you'd known more, you may well have been more aware of the challenges. So I think it worked out pretty well as it happened.
Thanks, Michelle. Yeah, it's first versus second term is one of the sort of hardy perennials of our sort of student essays when they cover Tony Blair. Tony Blair was asked also about his fear that the UK was slipping into a lower league.
One of the things that is really interesting about government when you study it is that you need two things for a country to do well. You need, despite changes in government, there to be a backbone of consistency in some of the policies and attitudes that allow a country to move forward. And you could say that this was present in one sense. You know, I didn't undo a lot of the Thatcher reforms around privatization. We didn't put the top rate of tax back up to where it had been, you know, when I was growing up, which is like over 80%. You know, but what we did was regard our job as rebuilding the public realm. But there was a kind of consistency of policy to a degree towards the private sector, which allowed us very high levels of economic growth. Likewise, when we came in, we made big social change. People forget this now, but Tories would fight elections against gay rights and against the minimum wage. Right? And, you know, by the time we'd ended, David Cameron was championing, you know, marriage between people of the same sex, and the minimum wage, we were fighting over who would raise it most. So, again, there's a consistency of policy. The problem with Western policy over the last 10 to 15 years, and we can debate all the reasons for this, when I was in government, Nigel Farage and Jeremy Corbyn were fringe figures. Right? If you said to me when I was prime minister, these are the two guys that are going to create big waves in British politics, I was, what? I literally would have thought you were living on a different planet. And it turns out that I was. So it's Farage essentially got pushed the Tory party ultimately to become a Brexit party, and we got Brexit, which, you know, I still think is a huge, huge challenge for the country. And you know, Jeremy Corbyn took over the Labour Party. But the result of that was that all that consistency went, and you got a full-on fight between fringe populists, or coming out of the fringe and into the mainstream. And I think it's had a really deleterious effect on our politics, likewise in America. And, you know, for the West, what that has meant is that we are weak at a very crucial time. And so for the UK, in my view, you've got to reassert a strong centre in its political life, which is looking for practical evidence-based solutions, for example, which is taking the technology revolution, which I think is the single biggest real-world event going on, and saying, well, how do we harness that for the public good? Not having a 1980s debate, for example, in healthcare, about who spends a bit more, or do we hire extra nurses and doctors, but actually saying, how does technology transform the way we do preventive health and public health and the way we organize our healthcare system? So this is my worry about Britain, is we're going through three revolutions. Brexit, which is a revolution, not one I like, but it's there, it's true. Climate, where we've got a huge ambition. And by the way, one of the things this Ukraine crisis is going to do is really, it's going to make, you know, people can be very supportive of what's happening now, but believe me, when the cost of living crisis really starts to squeeze, you'll find that there are elements on the right who make climate change a big problem for us politically. So you've got the climate ambition, and finally you've got this technology revolution. And my point is that the real problem with the country is not, you know, Partygate, you know, but it's the absence of a plan and the absence of a political class that's capable of thinking through these big, big challenges which are going to determine the future of the country and getting the right answer, which has really nothing to do with the politics of either Farage or Corbyn. So this is what I think is the challenge, and I think it's a big one.
John Rentoul, Blair there talking about not seeing the rise of Farage and Corbyn coming. I think his critics might say he was partly responsible for that. What's your take?
Well, absolutely. I thought it was classic Tony Blair there. Sort of a slightly fake modesty about his inability to see Jeremy Corbyn coming and the rise of populism generally. So much of his, Tony Blair's politics was built actually on the fact that he had a better reading of public opinion in this country. And, you know, in other answers that he gave to students. He was explaining how he saw the sort of opposition to uncontrolled immigration being a potential problem for his government, and how he had a better plan to take that on and to deflect it and to turn it back on Michael Howard, who was trying to exploit it opportunistically for the Conservatives. And yet he sort of says, "Oh well, you know, I thought they were fringe figures from another planet." And as you say, as you suggest, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's rise was a direct response to what a lot of people in the Labour Party thought were the disappointments of the new Labour years. So yes, I don't think Tony Blair did see Jeremy Corbyn coming, but then he was in quite good company in failing to see that.
Of course, looking at this period, you have to study the relationships at the very top of government. Here's Tony Blair on his relationship between himself and Gordon Brown.
Disagreements. they're mostly constructive. Towards the end, it was more difficult. Although even then, you know, the compromises you engaged in were sometimes necessary. It's a very difficult, you know, politics is a difficult business at a certain level, because, you know, I always used to say this to my own people who would complain about it from time to time. Look, you know, people are entitled to want your job. I mean, it's the way it is. And in politics, you know, they, it tends to be quite a long list. And, you know, there were points in time when it was very difficult with the relationship. But I always say this to people, and I mean it. In the end, Gordon was a huge strength to the government. You know, he's someone of a phenomenal intellectual capability. You know, if he was sitting here talking to you, and actually we should get him to do one of these days, but it's, you know, you would be very impressed. You know, and it's important to say that, because, you know, if you compare him today with what is in government, I think he stands up pretty well in terms of ability, heft, you know, capability of getting, you know, things sorted out and so on. And so, you know, the tension also, the other thing that was important with us, remember, no Labour government had ever lasted more than 6 years. And we lasted in the end 13. So we lasted twice as long as the previous Labour governments. And partly that was because we brought the disagreements inside the tent. And so even though he and I were, you know, points disagreeing about things like health and education reform, law and order reform, and so on, we managed to sort them out inside the tent. Whereas if you look at previous Labour governments, I mean, now people rewrite the history of this, you know, the Attlee government, you know, everyone got on, there was, you know, everyone thought Clem Attlee was fantastic. No, they didn't. The first thing they did when Labour came into power was try and get rid of the guy. And then, you know, there were big resignations from the government that really undermined the government in the end and meant that, you know, in 1951, despite all the things the Labour government had done, it went out of power and stayed out of power for 13 years. So, yeah, it was difficult at points. There's no getting away from that. But the overall, I think overall it was more constructive than destructive.
I mean, I think that was a fabulous answer from Tony Blair, you know, really working through why it was necessary, and also where it worked and where it didn't. I mean, their relationship was certainly, you know, constructive in opposition in the first term, in second term. It's not, you know, not to say there weren't tensions during that period, but I think it really worked well for the, you know, for the majority of that time. I mean, it starts to deteriorate in the third term, partly because, you know, Gordon Brown's getting more and more impatient about when he's going to take over as leader of the Labour Party and Prime Minister. But, you know, as Blair said, this big tent that New Labour offered, I mean, would it have been possible without these two big leaders pursuing their own, you know, legacies, their own agendas, Blair with public service reform and then Gordon Brown with welfare reform? You know, would one leader have been able to pursue both of these huge areas, and both of them, you know, in their own, with their own teams and with their own civil servants and advisors, managed to get their head around these huge agendas, you know, public service reform, reforming the NHS and the education system, transport and so forth, and the welfare reform, the tax credits that essentially gave, you know, to my mind, a universal basic income to working families. I don't know if one prime minister would have been able to do that. So I think, you know, you had these two huge minds with immense public service, morals guiding them. So I think, you know, that was important. But also you had a lack of opposition from the Conservative Party at the time. And so the opposition became internal. If there had been a credible opposition from the Conservative Party, then, you know, maybe things would have been different. Maybe there would have been a necessity to actually speak more with one voice. But I do think that there was a lot of bad feeling and suspicion created by the plans that were kind of being worked out but never were implemented to move Gordon Brown, you know, whether that be to the Foreign Office or whether to split the Treasury and create an Office of Management and Budget like they have in the US. I think, you know, those worries about different individuals and different plans were distracting and did create, suspicion, paranoia. And at times in the second term, you know, in the course of my PhD, I saw some of this. Motives were second guessed because is this about Blair pursuing his legacy and pursuing his, you know, extending his time as Prime Minister, or is this really about, this particular health policy? So I think that was an issue. But I mean, overall, absolutely, it created better policy outcomes because you had just these incredibly formidable minds trying to work out the best health policies, education policies, welfare policies. Not only from the civil service and the secretaries of state, but also the advisors, you know, the advisors in the Treasury, the advisors in the health department and in education, the advisors around Blair. It really, you know, it quite incredible to look at who the people they were able to draw to them were. They created this market for ideas, primarily Tony Blair created this market for ideas where they drew the best people to them. And I think Sally Morgan reflected on this when she came and spoke to our class, and she said, you know, essentially, in retrospect, they were dancing on a head of a pin. There wasn't a big, huge, gaps between what they were trying to achieve, but at the time they were really trying to fine-tune things, you know, big changes to the NHS or to the education system. You know, they were trying to make sure that that this was the best possible policy. And I think the secretaries of state at the time probably were most frustrated because, you know, they lost out to Gordon and Tony Blair choosing how they respond to, you know, an issue like the foundation hospitals is the big one where sort of Alan Milburn is squeezed out to an extent because the debate becomes between Blair and Brown. But, you know, it may well have been uncomfortable at lots of times, but when you look back in retrospect, I think, yeah, better policy outcomes, but I would say it was constructive.
Of course, the current state of UK politics is never far from our students' minds. Blair discussed how the Labour Party can get back into power and whether or not the centre ground has shifted.
The first thing is to realise the psychology of the country towards Labour and Tory is different. And, you know, unfortunately, if you look back on, 120 years of Labour existence, we've been in power for less than a third of that time, roughly a quarter of that time. And half of it was New Labour and parts of the Labour Party not too keen on remembering that part. So I always say to people, you can't say Labour's been a successful political project, really. Because if you take the 100 years before that, the Liberal Party, which was then the alternative to the Conservatives, I think they were about roughly equal in terms of the time they spent in government. And personally, I think the big defect at birth of Labour was to be tied to organised labour rather than be broadly progressive, right? And I think the separation of that Liberal tradition of progressive politics and the Labour tradition is the thing I tried to cure in New Labour, but, you know, after I left, people went back to the traditional roots of Labour, which I think was and is a mistake. And the difference that makes the psychology of the country towards the two parties is that with the Tories, you see, the country looks at the Tories and says, they only really care about power. Now, if you're Labour, you think, oh, that's really bad, really unprincipled. But the public finds that curiously comforting. Do you think they only care about power? So really, they're probably going to try and please me most of the time. So it's what we think is a point of criticism in a curious way electorally is really a point of reassurance. Now, when you come to Labour, Labour always thinks Labour's problem is whether it's principled or not. But I would say to them, the country knows we're principled. Oh, yes, we got those principles. And what they think is, yeah, if it comes to those principles and me, well, they might just choose the principles. Right. So in a curious way, what we think is very comforting, they find puts them on guard. I'm not saying they dislike it. They like the principles, the fact or the fact of principles. But it means that the first thing you've got to understand is that if you want as Labour to get power, you've got to have a clear and coherent vision of what you are, what you're not, and it's got to be laid out with crystal clarity for the public. Otherwise, the Tories are going to come along, frankly, and outmaneuver you, suggest that you may do a whole lot of things the public doesn't like, and the public gets that. I've seen this so many times, that the Tories become really unpopular. Labour ends up thinking it's going to win. You get a few months out from the election. The media starts ramping up for the Tories. The public thinks, yeah, I'm not sure, you know. And then they go into the privacy of that polling booth and, oh, it's another Tory government. Right. So what we wanted to do was to re-establish that progressive coalition, Labour and Liberal, create very openly a big tent where if you were a... I mean, I remember one of the first things that happened to me when I was Labour leader is I did a meeting and somebody got up in the course of the meeting and in a very critical way said to me, I think I've finally got what you're trying to do. You're trying to get Tories to vote Labour. Yeah, I am trying to get Tories to vote Labour. This was shocking. You know, I mean, if they were Tories, they were obviously bad people, so why did we want their vote anyway? No, so you've got to create a big coalition, and it's got to be based around values, not confused with policies, right? Policies are for this time or that time, values are for all time. So if you're looking at it today, like we've just been saying in healthcare, it's not, or energy, it's not, I mean, in energy, it's not about whether you have public ownership of the energy utilities or not. Really, you can have it, you can not have it. It's not gonna change the energy mix, change our ability to deal with climate change, change anything very much, other than bog a government down in legislation the public ultimately, whatever it might say, doesn't really care about. So you need then a policy program that is forward-looking. And that's your, you know, this is why I think for Labour today, harnessing this technology revolution is the thing. It's future-oriented, it's youth-oriented, it's business-oriented, and it allows you a big program where it's obvious it's only if government are prepared to be a partner in this revolution and the harnessing of the revolution that it's going to work. So you need that big program. You need, in addition, to play defense carefully. Now, the Tories have a whole series of populist rifts that serve them very well. It might be on immigration. Now it's increasingly on things like trans rights or whatever it may be. The culture wars, they're called culture wars. If you want to win, you've got to block off the routes of attack on that. And you can't have any dubiety. People think you're not solid on defense, you're not solid on law and order, you're not in a sensible place on these cultural questions. You don't recognize the immigration. Yes, I happen to believe immigration is a good thing for the country, not a bad thing, but there's got to be rules and order around it. If you're in a position where you're vulnerable on those things, you're just going to get slammed. So you've got to have your big program for the future. You've got to have your defense mechanisms, as it were, your defense, political defense mechanisms sorted out, particularly on the culture issue. And then finally, for Labour right now, look, you've got to... I think Labour, and this is one of the advantages of what Keir's doing, because I think he does understand this. But, you know, when you've done something as, you know, seismic as saying Jeremy Corbyn should be Prime Minister, and, you know, this, I mean, look, some of you may support him and fine, that's great, but the fact is the country was never going to elect him. And in constituencies like mine up in Sedgefield, where in 2005 we had an almost 20,000 majority, is now a Tory seat, there was no way they were ever going to accept them. Right. So when you've done something like that, it's got to be clear that that is over. If there's any doubt about that, and the Tories, by the way, will spend a large amount of their time raising that doubt, then we won't win those seats back. So sorry, that's a long answer, but Labour can win again. But, you know, when you're up against the Tories, you've got to be absolutely brutally ruthless about how you position yourself politically. You see, I think the centre ground's got a... I mean, this is the big question. Has the centre ground got a supply problem or a demand problem? And my view is it's got a supply problem. I think it's no coincidence that Macron won in France and will probably win again. Right. He's in the right position. I think Biden beat Trump ultimately. I'm not sure the Democrats understand this, but they beat him ultimately. Beat him ultimately because people thought he's a decent enough guy. He's pretty much in the center, and there are levels of acceptability beneath which Trump falls. I think in the UK, I've no doubt at all that had Labour been led in a sensible way as a left-of-centre progressive party in the way I've described, I think we'd have given the Tories a real run for the money in 2019. So I think the centre is still... you build out from there, especially if you're a progressive party. Because I always say to people, if a populism of the right meets a populism of the left, the populism of the right wins. So you need to build out from the centre. And the confusion in a lot of people's minds in the Labour Party is that they think when you say that, you're going back to the policies of New Labour. Well, the whole world's different, you know, from 25 years ago, of course. So the policies aren't the same, but the basic pitch, you know, forward-looking, modern, sensible, in the mainstream of politics, all those things that were hallmarks of what we tried to create with New Labour, still, you know, put it like this, we'd be in a much better position if it was clear that that's where we are. And I think the challenge for Keir, and I think he's done, you know, I think he's doing a really good job of shifting the Labour Party, but his challenge is that, you know, I took over in 1994 after Neil Kinnock and John Smith, both of whom had made major changes in Labour. He is the equivalent of taking over after 1983. So I think it's a much tougher thing, but I think, on the other hand, politics moves much faster today. But the centre is still the best place. I still think it's where the public responds. Actually, if you look at the polling, this is very clear. And we just need to recognise that the centre doesn't shift, but the context in which the centre operates shifts with shifting times.
John, you've highlighted this answer in your article in The Independent. Blair is clearly of the view that although the times are very different from 1997, the same fundamental lessons apply to getting a centre-left party to win in the United Kingdom.
Yes, no, he doesn't have any truck with the idea that centrism is a rude word, or that the centre ground in politics is an ambiguous and sort of nebulous idea. I mean, he really defends centrism in principle as being the way to democracy, and given that he won three elections himself, you know, I think he's able to speak with some authority on this subject. And it was interesting that he was endorsing Keir Starmer very much, saying that Keir Starmer understands the need to move to the centre ground. But I did notice there was a little bit of a barb in there, because he did point out that, you know, it's a seismic event for the Labour Party to propose someone like Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister, and that to get away from that is going to be a huge task. And there's a sort of hint in there that might be beyond Keir Starmer, because obviously Keir Starmer served in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet. So however much he was praising Jeremy Corbyn, I think he was also setting out the absolutely vast challenge that Keir Starmer says faces. Although he did say that politics moves faster, ever faster these days. So perhaps Keir Starmer can turn that round. But I think that was just being polite.
We will wait and see. I've got to leave it there. But John Rentoul, Michelle Clement, thank you so much for joining me. I think that's been a really insightful episode, and it's quite nice to give everyone a little snippet into what our very lucky students get on our modules. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll be back with you soon.